Good afternoon. I'd like to call the House Transportation Committee to order. Today is Thursday, February 23rd, 2023. We're in the Barnes Committee Room, Room 124 of the Alaska State Capitol Building, and let the record reflect that the time is 1:02. Today we have present Representative Craig Johnson, Representative McKay, Representative Stutes, and myself, Chair McCabe, so far. I expect the others will be here shortly. Representative Sumner has been previously excused. The staff assisting me today will be Recording Secretary Linda Jensen, Moderator Doug Bridge. Welcome to you two, Bridges.
Hi.
Welcome to you two, and thank you for your service. And my committee aide, Angela Steffel. Let the record show that Representative Mina has joined us. Today, the committee will be given two presentations from the DOT. First, we will hear a presentation from Chris Hodgen and Jason Sakalakis on the department's Division of Facility Services. Following that presentation, we will have an overview of the statewide equipment fleet by Brad Bilsma. Any questions from committee members before we start? Seeing none, Mr. Hodgen and I think Mr. Sakalakis is on teleconference. Welcome to House Transportation. Please have a seat and place your name on the record and begin the presentation.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, members of the committee. Thank you very much for the opportunity for us to share with you today. So for the record, my name is Christopher Hodgen. I am an engineer with our Department of Transportation and Public Facilities, and I am with our Division of Facility Services, and remotely on the line, I believe we have our director, Mr. Jason Sakalakis. So today we'll be sharing an overview of the division. So the division's overall mission is to deliver, improve, and maintain our facilities across Alaska with our values of integrity, excellence, respect, service, and safety. So the division provides these design, construction, and maintenance and leasing services as part of a holistic approach to state facilities and to be able to serve our Alaska clients for their facility needs. So this slide is the where we are now slide, and essentially it shows us where we are geographically. We have our main operational hubs in Fairbanks, Anchorage, and Juneau, which each of those hubs include our maintenance personnel, statewide public facilities personnel, administration personnel, and leasing team members as well. We also have several of our maintenance team members in our more remote areas to be able to serve our rural facilities, so they are spread out as well. Overall, the division has 149 positions spread across two budget components, which I'll talk about briefly in the next slide. So advancing to the next slide is where we'll talk about the functional areas and the two budget components of the division. So our Division of Facility Services, it's one results delivery unit, and it has four functional areas divided into two budget components. So our budget components, our main budget components, are leasing, which is one major budget component, and then a facility services budget component, which includes statewide public facilities, maintenance and operations, and administration. So next slide, we'll introduce our first functional area, which is statewide public facilities, and that's what I've been a part of. So our statewide public facilities functional area and statewide public facilities team, we include architects across all spectrums of disciplines and engineers. We also include professional project managers, energy professionals, contracting professionals, and our construction contracting officer. So the images on this slide show some of the projects that we've worked on. So the bottom image is our new snow removal equipment building in McGrath that was newly constructed recently. And at the upper right, we have two of our team members from our Fairbanks hub, our statewide public facilities team members, at our new Barrow combined maintenance facility. And then on the bottom right, we have three of our Juneau statewide public facilities team members. So advancing to the next slide, a little bit more about statewide public facilities and the projects that they do. We have projects that encompass both federal and state funded programs, and they're all related to facilities design and construction. So some examples of these projects could be FAA-funded airport projects, FTA-funded projects for vehicles and bus transportation, FEMA projects, and state-funded facility projects of all different scales. So at present, at the moment, we have over 170 projects at various stages and phases, of over $390 million. At the bottom, we can see some of our At the bottom of this slide, we can see some of our related statutes right now that are current to construction and public facilities. Then we can advance to the next slide. A little bit more, diving into a little bit more on the project delivery from statewide public facilities. Projects can range from smaller scale major maintenance renewal projects to $100 million plus major projects such as our library, archives, museum here in Juneau. We do engage in and utilize project management best practices, and we do have expertise in multiple project delivery methods, such as using professional term agreements, design bid build contracting, design build and best value contracting, also using construction management general contracting, and our energy savings performance contracting, which we'll cover briefly on the next slide. So at the bottom of this slide, we've got just an example of some of our major projects in the recent years, the Aquatic Center at Mount Edgecombe High School, the Public Safety Crime Lab in Anchorage, again, the Statewide Museum, and some of our major projects at our Anchorage Airport. So advancing to the next slide. As part of statewide public facilities, we do have our energy program. So in this program, energy efficiency projects are accomplished. So energy efficiency projects are done through a contract vehicle called Energy Savings Performance Contracting. And what that contract vehicle is being able to finance the projects and repay the projects over time from their resultant savings. So to date, at present, we have accomplished about 75 buildings, which we've executed those projects in, and the annual savings of over $4.2 million.
Question? I have a question. Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, could I learn more about what type of energy efficiency and energy saving developments that you do in these projects? Thank you.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Mina, thank you very much for the question. So we have done all types of different energy efficiency projects through these. They have included lighting upgrades, HVAC upgrades, building automation control upgrades. Sometimes they've also been renewable energy sources and cogeneration projects. So we do not limit ourselves to the type of technology or the types of energy efficiency projects that we accomplish through these, but we do take into consideration the viability and kind of the longevity of the upgrade we're going to do, and is it appropriate for this situation? So we've done all different types of energy efficiency projects. Thank you.
Awesome.
Thanks.
Thank you. And then I'll advance to our next slide. And our next slide, we introduce the next functional area of the division. It's our maintenance and operations functional area. So our maintenance professionals in the division, they span all of our building trades, including carpentry, electrical, HVAC, building automation, and more. They provide preventative and routine maintenance. They help do emergency repairs, emergency responses. They help protect our facility assets, and they help also identify deferred maintenance needs, reporting those deferred maintenance needs to some of our maintenance leaders. So on this slide, there's a couple of different images up here of some of the places that our maintenance team has responded to. The upper image is from our Dead Horse Airport, where they helped repair a pump failure that occurred there. And at the bottom, it's a roofing repair that they did at one of our Jim River stations. And we can advance to our next slide, which is more about our maintenance and operations team. This gives more of a perspective statewide. So across the state, there are over 1,900 state facilities. 731 of these facilities are owned by our Department of Transportation and Public Facilities, and our division provides maintenance for 835 of these facilities. For perspective, that means there are over 10 facilities for each of our maintenance professionals. So our maintenance professionals, not only do they serve our DOT facilities, but they serve our other partner departments, which include education, health, labor and workforce development, public safety, and DNR facilities, a select group within those facilities. The way that those facilities are cared for and they're serviced is through service level agreement. So service level agreements with our division and those partner agencies. And those service level agreements contain mutually agreed maintenance services that are within the set budgetary parameters that our clients have. And on the right, we can see some of our current focuses that our maintenance and operations team is working on now. And they're looking at addressing some of our geographic challenges of making it and providing maintenance services to a lot of our remote facilities, as well as being able to address and ascertain and understand each of those facility conditions and the needs.
So what's the criteria for taking on a building, say, with a service level agreement from another agency? Say the legislature wanted you to manage or take on a apartment complex kind of across the street, the frat house.
Thank you so much for the question, Chair McCabe. I'll answer, and then after I answer, I'll offer if the Director Sokolakis is online, he can add to it as well.
Okay.
So I would say some of the criteria that we look at or whether we take on another building is the geographic location of the building and the budget that the client has in order to provide maintenance services for the building, as well as does that client agency have any internal expertise in order to maintain that building? If they do not, then that is certainly justification and consideration for us to help provide those maintenance services to them. We also look at, in that consideration is, like a moment ago I talked about that ratio of how many facilities are to each of our maintenance professionals. We also have to look at, okay, what kind of additional volume does that add to our people, and would we actually be able to respond in a responsible way to help provide maintenance services? So those are all the types of consideration factors we do in the conversations with the departments. And then I can add, if Director Sokolakis is online, if you'd like to add anything to that, you are welcome to, sir.
Jason Sokolakis, Northern Region, Statewide Facilities Director. No, I think you did well there, Chris. If there's any follow-up questions, we can work those. Thank you.
Thank you.
Excellent. And we'll advance to our next slide. This slide just introduces our last two functional areas of the division. So we have our administration functional area and our leasing functional area. So our administration team, they provide all of our business support tasks that we need, operational budgeting and tracking. They track costs by building, and they provide that to our maintenance managers. So it's a very, very valuable function that our administration team provides us regularly. Then we have our leasing team, and our leasing team is comprised of our contracting officers, and these are leasing contracting officer professionals. They serve all of our executive branch departments. They help manage and provide and procure leases from both private owners as well as help manage our occupancy agreements in our state buildings. And then as we advance to the next slide, this is just a little bit more detail on some of the duties and the tasks that our leasing team helps us with. So they definitely help evaluate, negotiate, and procure all the state leases on behalf of the agencies. And they provide regular oversight and provide assistance whenever the tenants have concerns. Some of their other duties on the right, they're a key They're a key team member in helping to provide and ascertain conditions when building closure notifications need to be done. So they help with that. They also provide our construction delegations for tenants that would like to do their own construction and leases. And again, occupancy management. And moving to our next slide, this slide is on our computerized maintenance management system. So this is an enterprise-wide tool. The CMMS is a tool that facilities professionals and facilities organizations use. It is essentially a tool for managing facility work orders, the assets that are within those facilities, the lease spaces that are within those facilities, and the capital improvements that are within those facilities, all within an enterprise software platform. With the current system that we're using, there are several modules that are available in the system. Right now, they are in various levels of implementation, so not all of them have been implemented yet. But at present, the module that we are using is maintenance work order module, and then the brand name that the system that they use is called Operate. So we're using the CMMS system, using it to manage our work orders through that. Thank you. Our next slide is just a high-level overview summary of the different budget components that are in the division. The two budget components, again, we have our facilities services budget component and our leases budget component. The leases budget component is essentially pass-through. And then our facilities service budget component includes statewide public facilities, our maintenance and operations team, and our admin team for overall aggregate operating budget of authority of $98.7 million.
So when you say pass-through, you mean, say, the DPS wants to lease a building in Nome. They provide the money through you, you're leasing authority, and you're leasing guys, you lease the building, and it kind of works that. So that's the pass through. Okay.
Yes, sir. Chair McCabe, that is correct. Yes. Thank you. Thank you for the question. The next slide is just a little bit more detail with regards to that budget authority, breaking it down within the various funding sources. So in just some highlights here, in orange, it represents our lease agreement interagency receipts. In green is our maintenance service level agreements that we have with our partners, our department partners that we have service level agreements with. Purple is represents our operating, maintenance, and utilities of our public building fund buildings. So those are our main major state office buildings that we have, like the Atwood building in Anchorage and our state office building in Juneau. And then advancing to our next slide, these are just overall challenges and reflection that the division is working through in the last few years that I'm sure are shared with other divisions too. But just to highlight some of these, you know, recruitment and retention certainly is a challenge. We have some of our highest vacancy rates in our statewide public facilities functional area and within our maintenance and operations functional area. We do still have, you know, our big state deferred maintenance backlog of projects. So being able to keep pace with that and kind of manage those projects and kind of keep that flow going is always a challenge. In our maintenance and operations side, we always have challenges with logistics on getting our material and personnel to some of the rural areas. Always maintaining service levels with increasing utility and commodity costs is a challenge. And some of the challenges that we've seen recently within the last couple of years, especially, is the volatility of the construction economy. So we've had vast fluctuations in our construction contracting prices. So what this has caused is having to go back and reflect on what can truly be achieved with a project's budget or scope. And so this has caused some iterative work that's had been done just with some volatility on construction prices. then we always have.
Good.
Then there's we always have the challenge of constrained resources with our engineering professionals and the our contracting resources.
Thanks, and let the record show that Representative Vance joined us at 1:20.
Thank you. Our next slide is just an example slide. This is from an earlier presentation that we did with the Senate and House Finance Committees, but just to illustrate the deferred maintenance backlog that is across some of our executive branch agencies. Approximately $703 million in deferred maintenance projects identified, and this does not include the university.
Can you give me an example of some of the deferred maintenance projects?
Yes, thank you very much for the question, Chair McCabe. So some of our deferred maintenance projects include roofing renewals, siding renewals, boiler upgrades, or major HVAC improvements where the ventilation systems have failed, window replacements, and I think that's a good example of a lot of the deferred maintenance projects we have.
So do you prioritize? I mean, you must have a priority system based on what the highest priority projects. You know, if you have an HVAC system that fails, obviously you're gonna have to fix that pretty quickly. You know, in the wintertime. So you have a priority system, or do you have a list, like, you know, dealing with the DOT and you know, roads. We have a RIP list, right? You know, the road service areas have a RIP list, and priorities change on there depending on the. So do you have a list that you pass out, or are we getting to that maybe? I don't know.
I would thank you so much for the question. I'd love to be able to talk about that now. That's an excellent question. So we do. So we work with OMB, and we also work with our state partners as part of an overall facilities council. So in that facilities council, it involves representatives from each of our executive branch departments that own facilities. Through the process of evaluating deferred maintenance projects, we've developed a methodology to prioritize them. So that methodology includes like three factors. So we create what we call project index values to be able to rank these projects. And the factors that go into ranking them include what we call a mission alignment index of the facility. That mission alignment index directly ties to how important is that particular facility for that department in order to meet its mission. That department is the one that provides the value for that mission alignment index. We also have a system factor. The system factor is a scaled factor that takes into account the different components of the building, whether it's HVAC, electrical, building envelope, or health safety. So if it's health safety, then it automatically scales like very high. Then we have a need factor. A need is essentially how soon does it need to be done, critical or urgent, or is it necessary? So all of those factors, we sum them together and to provide a project index value. The factors of the system factor and the need, those are contributed to by the representatives of the State Facilities Council. So each member provides their own score. Those scores are averaged, and then they're multiplied by the mission alignment index that is provided by the department, and we create a project index value to rank all of these. So that's the facilities council, then they deliberate on it. They see the rankings. They make any adjustments that they would need, and then they share that with OMB for the priority.
How often does the facilities council meet?
Thank you for the question. In general, it's been about quarterly, and it's more frequent. It is more frequent when they have to do the prioritizations.
And so there's a representative from each of your, you know, obviously a DOT rep or PF rep, but also a rep from each one of your user groups, so to speak.
Yes. Thank you for the question, Chair McCabe. Yes, there's a representative from each of the user groups that that own facilities. So there might be some agencies that do not own facilities, and they don't have a representative there.
Thanks. Anyone else? On we go. Well, Rep. Vance has a question.
Thank you, through the chair. I'm looking at this chart. Can you explain the difference between the tallest graph that says DOT and PF, and then a few over is a smaller one that says DOT and PF, PBF?
Thank you for the question. To the chair, Representative Vance, I will answer, and then I'll ask if Director Sokolaskis has any input for that. But on the far left-hand side, the tall one for our DOT and PF buildings, those represent like all of our airport buildings, our snow removable equipment buildings, our DOT-centric buildings. The DOT PBF, a few bars over, those are our state office buildings that are served from the Public Building Fund account. So there are 11 of those, a handful in Juneau, in Anchorage, and in Palmer, but some representative buildings from those are, like, there's the Douglas Island building in Juneau, there's our state office building in Juneau, there's our Palmer state office building in Palmer, and our Atwood building in Anchorage. So that's a representative of those DOT PBF buildings.
Thank you.
Who else? All right, moving along. Thanks.
Thank you. And our concluding slide for our Division of Facility Services just highlights some of the relationships we've developed and some of our high-level goals that we have. But like through this, the relationships we've developed, certainly the relationship with the Facilities Council, being able to organize, facilitate, and lead that Facilities Council. We do work with OMB on whatever various facilities support topics that they may need. In particular, that's helping to prioritize the deferred maintenance projects through the state. And then some of our highlight goals include always continuous improvement on all of our systems, and being able to kind of expand our successful maintenance projects successful maintenance practices and improve upon our project delivery techniques. So that concludes our relationships and goals.
So of the 149 PCNs that you have, do you have any that are sort of permanently stationed? Like, do you have one that's stays in the Atwood building, say, and is responsible for the contracting out the janitors or the security or that sort of thing? Or are you guys just sort of the overarching or the overall managers? And one guy might have six buildings and he's in Juneau or Anchorage or wherever.
Thank you for the question, Chair McCabe. For example, specific to the Atwood building, we do have a facilities manager that resides like at the Atwood building, taking care of the Atwood building needs. So he does have an office there and takes care of that. At the moment, he's also helping he has a couple different duties. So at the moment, he's also helping with the Palmer State Office building as well. So that's one example I have for someone that resides at a particular building. And then I'll ask Director Sokolaskis if you have any other examples of that.
Sure, Jason Sokolaskis, Division Director of Facilities, for the record. So I will say, Chair McCabe, we do have personnel stationed, I'll say, throughout Alaska, as we've shown earlier there, and it does vary with regards to whether we got to have a staff to an assigned building or whether they are assigned to a hub location and manage various different buildings. So Chris did speak to one there with regards to the Atwood. We do have other scenarios that we have state office buildings, such as in Nome, where they're actually managed by a hub office, to where those individuals that are stationed there, we have three crew members there that actually respond to various DOT and CBF type buildings. So it does change in the locations where you go, and that's just as DFS has grown responsibility and gain some personnel that I'll say kind of changes as we onboard new clientele and departments too. So it's a little bit of mix as you go across the state.
Thank you. You also, Representative Mina has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, I might have missed this, but under OMB, what is the divestment initiative?
Thank you for the question. Through the chair, Representative Mina, this is a little bit a few years ago, but the initiative from OMB was, do we have any facilities that we do not have use for and that we could divest so that we can no longer have to maintain them or pay any deferred maintenance, pay for any deferred maintenance projects with them. So we did do an initiative, and it involved multiple other departments to identify the various facilities that could be divested. So a report of the different facilities that could be divested that was identified by each of the departments was submitted to OMB and included a handful of facilities. Within the DOT, there were a handful, like some snow removal equipment buildings that we no longer needed, some facilities at Coolis that we did divest, and then other departments had theirs as well. So, thank you.
Follow up. Could I learn more about the snow removal equipment building?
Yes, we'd be happy to come back to the committee and provide that for you.
Thank you.
Anyone else? All right, Mr. Hodgin, looks like you're off the hook. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it. We'll take a brief at ease here while we get ready for the next presentation. Back on the record. So next is Mr. Brad Bielsma. Did I say that right?
Bielsma.
He's going to give us a presentation on the statewide equipment fleet from the equipment fleet manager. He's the equipment fleet manager. Well, Mr. Bielsma, welcome to House Transportation. Please place your name on the record and begin your presentation.
For the record, my name is Brad Bielsma. I am the equipment fleet manager for the state equipment fleet. Thank you, Chair McCabe and committee, for having us here today to give you a quick overview of State Equipment Fleet, or SEF as we're commonly called, operations. And so the State Equipment Fleet has 158 PCNs located, much like facility services. We are a shared service that services all departments within the state of Alaska. 158 PCNs, most of those are mechanics and technicians. Spread across the state, we have manned shops from in all regions, 54 shops located all across the state. Additional support staff include contracting staff for equipment and vehicle purchasing. We have a parts staff spread out across the state in seven locations to provide parts for maintenance and repairs. Some admin staff and some technical support staff, and there are five district managers that manage the day-to-day operations. Again, we cover all facets of equipment and vehicle management, from the purchase to the disposal, as well as the maintenance and repair. We do some of our own modifications when we purchase new equipment to upfit them for their specific need. We also manage the fuel card program for all state vehicles. That's included as a part of our budget. We'll talk about that a little bit later. Also provide a sort of backup or supplementary labor resource pool for different divisions of DOT, the Highways and Aviation Maintenance and Operations. We assist with snow removal when needed, airport fire and rescue when needed, Department of Natural Resources, Forestry. We help out fighting forest fires or providing logistical support on site for forestry during the summer. One that's not on here, but is additional, we do assist DFS, facility services, from time to time with remote generator maintenance and facilities and things like that. Our mission is to provide all state agencies with safe, economical vehicles and equipment that are needed to accomplish their mission. This slide also provides a breakdown. There are There are SDF vehicles in every executive branch department, as well as the court system and legislative affairs. DOT, we reside, of course, within DOT and PF. DOT is also our largest customer, as you can see there. Department of Public Safety, Fish and Game, and Natural Resources and Corrections being the next level of as far as who our largest customers are. One thing to note here, State Equipment Fleet does not do, we do not manage ATVs or snow machines or planes or boats. Each individual department has that need, manages those. We do, when required or requested, we do provide maintenance for those types of vehicles, but it's not, those type of numbers are not included in this list. SDF manages the Highway Equipment Working Capital Fund, or HUCUF as it's commonly called. This is our internal service fund that we use to fund and manage both the maintenance and the replacement of fleet vehicles. SDF does receive, as a part of the general budget appropriations, we receive two appropriations for the HUCUF. We do not receive direct appropriations from the general fund. All of the actual funding for our operations and the replacement of vehicles comes from the rates that we charge and the rates and fees that we charge to individual end users. Have a pretty complex rate system designed to, number one, break even. The rates that we charge are designed to cover our costs and nothing more. But also to allocate those costs to the individual vehicles or pieces of equipment or departments that use our assets. So DOT being our biggest customer, they're also the biggest, they pay the largest chunk of rates to SDF.
So I think you said you allocate it per vehicle, so you probably have a pretty good idea of the useful life of a trooper vehicle and how much it costs over its lifetime to maintain it and do the routine maintenance and that sort of thing.
Chairman McCabe, yeah, thank you for the question. Yes, we do. We have, similar to what Mr. Hodgson was explaining with their CMMS system, we have a very similar system specifically dedicated to tracking the maintenance cost as well as depreciation and the capital costs of each individual piece of equipment. We charge out all of our work specifically to a piece of equipment, so we know, as well as any parts or supplies costs that are included. So we track the maintenance cost as well as the capital cost by asset, and that feeds those rates as in terms of what we charge our chargeback rates to the end users.
That's kind of cool. What's the most expensive vehicle to maintain?
Chair McCabe. Thank you for the question. It does depend on the day, but frequently the larger snowblowers being some of the more expensive equipment. If you look at it per hour that they run, it really varies. DPS state trooper vehicles, they run those vehicles very hard as a part of their mission and a part of their job. That racks up quite a bit of maintenance costs. So a state trooper pursuit vehicle obviously costs quite a bit more than say an administrative vehicle in another department.
Hmm. That's kind of interesting, actually. Yeah. I knew there was a reason I didn't buy a snowblower.
Again, SDF is a shared service. All executive branch departments have a fleet vehicle, at least one fleet vehicle. We had that breakdown earlier. We do also provide some asset management services for the quasi-government or agencies like the Alaska Housing, University, Alaska Railroad. Most of those services involve the license and titling of vehicles and equipment. We're our own DMV, so to speak, so we manage all of anything that has an official use only license plate comes through our office. We do, on request or when needed, we can provide repair services for any of those organizations as well. So there are times when it makes makes good practical sense for Alaska Housing, for example, to use our mechanics and our maintenance facilities to maintain their vehicles, and then there's other times they're not. So they're not obligated to do that, but it is an option for them when needed.
So how does that work? They just call you up like a normal repair shop, Brad's Garage, and they call you and they say, hey, I need to get my one ton in for a grease oil filter, and they just schedule it? Is that it? Yeah.
Chair McCabe, it works very much like that. They don't call Brad's Garage. They call the local foreman and can arrange that. And, of course, it is dependent on our workload and availability. But it gives them an extra option. AHFC, for example, I don't know specifically, but I know that they used to use private garages for all of their maintenance. And so it's just an extra option for them. It works for the railroad in some remote locations at times. It's just optional for them. And, yeah, they call us up, and we pick up the phone when they call.
Cool.
This slide's an overview of our budget over the last few fiscal years. On the operating side, the incremental increases you see there are tied to the increases in personnel costs from increased benefit costs or increases tied to collective bargaining agreements. The capital side we'll get to in the next slide or two. Down on the right there, you can see some examples, though, of increased, this is purchase costs for different classes of equipment. The loader and the motor grader there, you can see a 15 to 20% increase, so just over 2 years. The other interesting one there, the three-quarter ton crew cab, which is a large part of our fleet, 50% increase in price, in purchase price, over the past 2 years. Mostly due, I think everybody can relate or has had this experience with driving by car dealerships, and there's just nothing on the lot, and that's reflected in the price and the discounts they give to government.
So how do you buy it from local dealers, or do you buy it from fleet down in Detroit, or how does that work?
Thank you for the question, Chair McCabe. We do buy through local vendors, through local dealerships. On the light-duty side for cars and trucks with the major manufacturers, they do offer government discounts, fleet discounts, things like that. It all works through the local dealership. Part of the increase in price that you're seeing there is a reflection of a drastic reduction in those fleet and government discounts that we enjoyed for many years. And with the supply chain situation for the last couple of years, they just definitely tightened that up. And those increases are a reflection of that. We do purchase most of our equipment and most of our repair parts and supplies through local vendors.
Thanks.
All right, this slide is a little bit wider or a little bit broader look at our replacement and capital funding. What you see there on the brown line is the legislative authority that we receive annually for replacing equipment. You can kind of see from about 2005 to 2021 or so, fairly flat. There's a few spikes, but for the most part, fairly flat. The blue line is a reflection of what we collect in replacement rates from our end users. And again, those replacement rates are calculated on the concept of collecting enough funds in the HUCUP so that when it's time to replace that piece of equipment, we have the funds, and each agency does not have to come to you folks and ask for additional funding. With the rate collection over the last 15 years or so being higher than our available LA, our available legislative authority, a couple things as a result of that. One is a backlog of assets that we need to replace, and also a collection of funds in the HUCUF reserves to make those replacements. So in the past couple years, we've seen increased legislative authority that's allows us to address that backlog and replace some equipment and vehicles that are that have been need to be replaced for quite some time.
Representative McKay has a question.
Yeah, thank you. On that last slide, so who sets the replacement rate, the blue line? I guess if I was running a private business, I would raise the rates so that the blue line matched the red line, right? And, but you're not doing that, or maybe you could explain that.
Sure. Through the chair, Representative McKay, you're on the right track, and yes, to answer the first part of that question, we set these rates annually. We reevaluate them annually, and replacement rates are based on the replacement cost of an asset, roughly matches the depreciation value, but we're collecting for a replacement vehicle, not just the cost of the one that's in service now. As costs go up, then we have to increase those rates so that we come up with enough funding there. Well, what you're seeing here through the middle portion of this chart is where all of these rates are calculated on an individual basis, designed to, in the end, at the end of each asset life, to have enough funds to replace it. What we've had through the middle of the chart there is not enough legislative authority to spend that money. So we've collected the money, it resulting in not being able to replace them, so we have a backlog of assets to replace. The increased authority over the past few years has allowed us to address that.
Okay, thank you.
Operating budget breakdown. A large portion, about half of our operating budget goes towards personnel costs. The other large chunk of our budget in purple there is commodities, mostly repair commodities, supplies, oils, tires, anything you need to maintain and repair equipment and vehicles. Also included in the purple section, in the commodity section, is the fuel costs for all state vehicles. So those 3,300 fuel cards that are issued to state vehicles, all of their fuel costs come through our budget. And similar to what Mr. Hodgen was referring to earlier, it's a pass-through. It hits our budget, and then we charge the individual users for their fuel costs. We have a separate fuel card instead of just your standard P card that a lot of state employees have. The reason for that is when we do it through a consolidated billing program like we have with the separate card, we're able to separate the fuel taxes. Of course, the state of Alaska does not pay or is exempt from paying local, state, and federal fuel taxes. So through this program, we're able to eliminate the fuel tax charge to the end user.
But you're not hedging any. I mean, you're not storing fuel or hedging any fuel to speak of. You just, it's kind of on a as used or as needed.
Thank you for the question, Chair McCabe. The fuel card program that SEF manages allows anyone driving a state vehicle to go to a commercial filling station and fill up their vehicle. Vastly expanded flexibility from coming to a state-owned fuel station. DOT and PF does have bulk fuel facilities for maintenance and operations for them to be able to fuel their equipment. That's separate from this budget and this component.
Thanks.
Sure. Challenges, new and old. We work through, are facing workforce challenges like never before. I've been with the state for 23 years, we have never seen vacancy rates like we're seeing it at this time. Something I think you've heard from probably all of our components that have presented to you already. It affects us for the fleet. Many of our locations in rural Alaska or our smaller shops, they are one mechanic shop. So if that position is vacant, then we do not have a presence there to maintain equipment. So that makes it that much more difficult. Logistically, we have to fly someone there. We have to have someone travel to maintain equipment, maintain vehicles. We do have three main hubs in Juneau and Anchorage and Fairbanks, and the workforce challenges that we're seeing are not specific to urban or rural. We're seeing it system-wide at this point. Supply chain challenges. We used to, for our standard process for ordering vehicles, we used to be able to order vehicles just about year-round. Now the window for ordering vehicles from manufacturers has shrunk sometimes to as small as 2 weeks during the year that we're able to put in orders. What hasn't shrunk is the time to fill those orders. That has greatly expanded. Average time to order a vehicle and have it show up on the ground here used to be about 120 days. It is now well over a year to order a fleet vehicle, have it manufactured and delivered through the dealership. Lots of situations where there's longer lead times with repair parts and equipment, not just parts, but when we rely on the vendor community or the private vendors for repairs, they're suffering through the same workforce challenges that we are, so they're not near as available as we'd like them to be. Emissions and electronics challenges. Since 2014, every diesel engine that's been manufactured is required to have an after-treatment system with DEF. DEF is diesel exhaust fluid. DEF is not friendly, or it is not cold weather friendly, I guess is probably the best way to say it. It's a chemical. It's very finicky in cold weather, creates a lot of issues for equipment. Not just DEF or emissions treatments issues, but all heavy equipment now comes with as much electronics as you're going to find on a sports car, and all of that electronics again not conducive to working in cold, wet weather, which is where our equipment mostly works. What the result of that is everything that has electronics or control modules like that, it requires a laptop computer or a diagnostic laptop computer to maintain that equipment. So in the past, when you just grabbed a hammer and a wrench and a welding torch and repaired a grader, now you need a laptop computer, and that laptop computer may have as many as a dozen different software applications on it that are required to keep equipment running. So we have about between 75 and 80 dedicated diagnostic laptops. They're, of course, spread all throughout the state. Again, each one of them may have up to a dozen different applications on it. Some of those applications do not play well with other applications, so we have to have two laptops in an individual location in some cases. Quite a few of our the DOT PF facilities, shop facilities, were built in the 70s and early 80s when equipment was smaller, but it was also, we didn't ask it to do as much. So a grader or a plow truck that we have now, we're hanging additional components and additional requirements on, some of outgrowing some of the facilities that we have. And not just size-wise, not just outgrowing them physically, but communications and network availability and internet connectivity issues, especially in remote areas that present some challenges for us.
Good question. I think Representative McKay has a question.
Yeah, thank you. Through the chair, thank you for the presentation. Who is mandating the DEF additive and after treatment systems? Who's causing that to happen? I think I know, but I want to hear it.
Through the chair, Representative McKay, those are federal emissions requirements. Commonly referred to, you may have heard the term Tier 4 emissions. It was a tiered system that was phased in over several years to reduce emissions in diesel engines.
So if we, okay, follow up. Sure. So I live in Anchorage, so if we don't have an air quality problem in Anchorage. Why do we have to do that?
Through the chair, Representative McKay, that is a great question, but one I can't answer for you because it's federally mandated as part of federal emissions requirements. I'd love to have a better answer for you, but.
So federally mandated, but we're not exempt like usually years past. Lots of the governmental entities were exempt from some of those because of this exact thing, because it's one thing to have a bright, shiny diesel truck parked in your garage at night that stays nice and warm, and it's another thing with the DOT that's out there blasting around in the mud, in the snow and stuff, and freezing. And so I guess the answer to that is probably no.
Chair McCabe, the answer is the military has some limited exemptions in that case. There are some rare cases where emergency, like fire and ambulance equipment, has exemptions in that case. We have explored that as an option. We have certainly not gotten very far or very positive responses in that regard. It does present its own set of challenges. If we were to, I'll just leave it at that. Even if we were successful, there would be some challenges involved there as well.
Right. Representative Vance.
Thank you, through the chair. I'd like to talk more about the electronics not suited for severe climate. Clearly, there are other northern states with extreme weather that are probably dealing with similar issues. My first question is, are you pleased with the newer models of vehicles that require these electronics? Do they perform that much better than the old school editions? If not, have you considered talking with the manufacturers and joining with other northern states to see if maybe they could provide, if they're still manufacturing simplified models so that we can have easier ability to repair?
Through the chair, Representative Vance, thank you for the question. It is obviously a problem that is common to other northern states, and it is also not specific to government equipment. It's private sector equipment. All over Alaska faces the same thing. To answer the second part of your question, are we satisfied? That's the challenge. Is a lot of these electronic components, they are difficult to repair. They are difficult to diagnose. They're difficult to work on, and they can be very finicky. It's a whole lot more wiring. It's a whole lot more connections. Again, there are as many computers on a road grader now as there is on a BMW. It presents an entirely different set of challenges. It's things we have to adapt to. And to get to your other point, we do converse with other state DOTs on a fairly regular basis. This is not a problem exclusive to Alaska for sure, and it's something that we have discussed, that's been discussed, been approached. I would say not really making too much progress in that regard. A lot of new equipment is very reliable. It is advances in, and again, a lot of these advances, there are positives to this as well, where, electronically controlled equipment can be calibrated much better, can run more efficiently. When it all runs properly, it is an improvement. Safety concerns as well, communications that are available. So there are positives to newer equipment. They just also provide quite a bit of challenges in maintaining them and keeping them running.
Mm-hmm. Representative Mina has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, in terms going back to the workforce challenges, so for some of the vacancies that you were talking about, are people aging out and retiring? Are these generally more transient positions? Are they flocking to other jobs that are well paying? What's the recent context for recruitment?
Through the chair, Representative Mina, thank you for the question. The answer is all of the above. We have the gentleman that you see in the photo there has been working for us for, I believe, 28 years, and he is retiring this summer. We do have many of our, the vacancies in our workforce are the result of people that are leaving that are not retiring. So it's really a combination of both.
Thanks. On we go.
On we go. So I was reviewing this slide last night, and I thought I should have renamed the title from Solutions to Strategies, because we certainly don't have the ultimate solution to all of these issues. For our workforce challenges that we face, we have been shifting a lot of our positions to more of a hub type of staffing model. For instance, we used to have a permanent mechanic stationed in Antioch. We're unable to recruit there, successfully recruit a qualified applicant over the course of a significant length of time. So what we've done is move that position to Anchorage, and we still service Antioch vehicles using that position, but he's obviously not on the ground in Antioch to handle the day-to-day. It allows us a little more flexibility and be able to be a little bit more agile or mobile in responding to things around the state, but it does the downside of that is not having folks on site. And with DOT owning 240 airports, that if there's an airport, there's a piece of equipment to maintain it. And so, you know, being closer to that in rural locations makes it much easier. But having more staff at our hub locations gives us a little more flexibility to go different directions. Also, have been much more flexible in different work schedules, alternative work schedules. I believe you folks have heard of the two-on, two-off schedule on the Dalton Highway. We have expanded that within the fleet to other locations in order to kind of match those type of challenges. An example being in Bethel, all of our mechanics work week on, week off, and they actually all live in the Anchorage area. So they report to work for a week, they repair equipment, they fly out to the rural villages, and then they're off. And so we're doing more of that in more locations than just the Dalton. Also, more flexible as far as the work week. I believe we have folks that start their shift on every day of the week except for Sunday. So rather than just a Monday to Friday or a Monday to Thursday or something like that, we've been able to modify schedules, make it a little more attractive or a little more flexible for both new mechanics coming in, but also mechanics that are with us already that we want to retain. Supply chain challenges and solutions. One of the things that we've been doing in the last few years, rather than disposing of equipment that is no longer roadworthy or damaged or wrecked or totaled, we've been holding on to those pieces of equipment and using them for spare parts. This helps us financially, for one, just not paying for some repair parts, and obviously we do spend quite a bit of money on parts, but even more than financially, just the availability of having parts close by or locally when you know there's several instances where we're waiting months and months and months. We had an engine replacement in a light duty vehicle, and we waited over 15 months just to procure an engine. So a lot of those things are we're adapting and holding on to a lot of older, you know, it looks like a wreck, and it is a wreck, but we're able to use spare parts from those to keep the equipment, the active equipment, on the road. We have expanded our use of the federal surplus. purchased parts and whole equipment that is surplus from the federal government. Another example there, we recently purchased a vehicle from GSA and it was totaled, and we did it for the sole purpose of procuring the engine to address the problem that I just talked about before. And our parts staff searches for parts all over the world at this point, as far as finding repair parts and supplies to keep equipment and vehicles on the road. Some of the things that we're doing to address those emissions and electronics issues in cold weather climates, we have been rebuilding old road graders that don't have the DEF requirements or the emission systems. So you have a 20-year-old grader that is set to be replaced, and rather than purchasing a new grader, a Tier 4 engine grader, we are working with a local dealership and stripping that down to the frame and rebuilding it from the frame up. So a rebuilt engine, a rebuilt transmission, rebuild all of the other major components, and what you end up with is a like-new grader that does not have Tier 4 emissions. It's worked well on graders. We're looking to expand that into other equipment, but that's primarily the focus where that's working the best. SCF, we do provide our own warranty services for Ford and GM and most manufacturers of heavy equipment. What this does for us, it saves us a lot of time. Rather than when we have a warranty repair or a recall, whether it be a safety recall or just any kind of factory recall, rather than going to the dealership and waiting in line to get that repair completed, we're able to perform our own warranty services and then get reimbursed from the manufacturer, whether it's GM or Ford. It saves us a lot of time. We're able to collect a small amount of money for our time, but it helps us turn vehicles around and get them back on the road much quicker than if we're taking them to the dealership. The last line there pertains to plow trucks, which we used to purchase as a whole unit with the plow, the truck, the plow, the sander, the belly blade, the brine system. What we've been finding recently is that what works for us is we've switched in many cases to just purchasing a cab and chassis and then recycling and reusing a lot of the equipment, the plows and the sanders and blades and things. What that does, it obviously a lower cost on the replacement side, but we're also able to turn those around quicker as well.
So I have a couple questions. Sure. First, I have a 1957 Cat 12 that I'd be happy to donate if you guys want to rebuild it, as long as I get it back when you're done. What I'm curious of is the warranty services. So do your mechanics then have to go be Ford certified, trained to perform the warranty services so they get some schooling out of it and that sort of thing?
Chair McCabe, yes, that they do. We are required to certify, so to speak, as a warranty service center. The manufacturers have a system or a program in place that we have to qualify for that. We mainly do this in our larger shops, Anchorage and Fairbanks. And yes, the technicians there have to go through some training to be able to do those things. And we as a facility as well have to, you know, meet some requirements to be able to do that. And then there's an entire process for submitting the warranty claim to get reimbursed, which is a job in itself.
So you would be sort of eligible for some of the high school programs and the early programs where, like the old Ford Asset program, or there's a new one in Wasilla. It's a Kubota dealer, diesel certification. But point being is if a high school put some sort of a certification program into place, or even a two-year college that would certify somebody coming out, that would be an attractive employee for you because he already has a certification. Or is it just better for you guys to do it?
Chair McCabe, it certainly would be a better situation, or it certainly is advantageous for any of those, anyone that is a graduate of any of those programs. We welcome that. We do work with Avtech, for example. We've hired several folks straight out of Avtech. In regards to how that would impact or the impact of SCF being a warranty center, they would still need to do the actual training required, and be happy to provide that. But certainly something that we can take in as something to look at as a partnerships with the locations that you mentioned.
Cool. Any other questions? Yes, Representative Stutz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, I'm going to call you Brad in an effort not to mispronounce your last name. So I just want to compliment you on your ingenuity on how you're getting around some of these issues that have created issues for the state and for your whole department there. And I really think that's really commendable, and I'm happy to hear the avenues that you're taking to maintain a good fleet under the most difficult conditions.
Through the chair, Representative Stutz, thank you. You can call. I'll my name gets butchered all the time, so don't worry about it. But thank you for that observation, and I will just say that within our organization, 125 mechanics, these folks are many of them are career mechanics and repair people. It's in their nature, and it's in their core to solve problems. So it's something that we all take a lot of pride in. It's something that it goes from the top down. It's certainly not myself that comes up with all of these ideas. It's our organization as a whole. But thank you again.
Anyone else? Okay. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm wondering, do you warehouse parts or do you on demand? And if so, what you have a warehouse? You have a system, obviously, to maintain them. And have you found an advantage to buying on demand or warehousing or?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, we do warehouse parts. We have larger warehouses in our hub locations. We have part staff on hand that manage those parts warehouses. We do buy quite a few things as needed or on demand. So it's a combination of both. We try to keep in stock things that are general maintenance items or things that are recurring preventive maintenance type things. We stock tires, we stock oils, we stock a lot of those kind of things. With the wide variety of equipment that not only DOT, but the troopers, DNR, forestry, corrections, all of them, with the wide variety of equipment and vehicles we have, it's impossible to stock everything. So we do buy quite a bit on demand. Probably 95% of our purchases are through local dealerships and vendors, whether they be aftermarket light duty vendors or equipment dealerships.
Well, different question. Have you looked at standardization of vehicles so that if you only have Fords or GMs, then you can? Is that something that you've looked at? And I noticed in here there are several kinds of front end loaders, and so.
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, yes, we do, and so. While in the presentation, you probably saw several different brands of loaders, you also are seeing loaders that are anywhere from 2 to about 30 years old. The one we're looking at here is, I believe, a 1990 right. model Michigan loader. And so we do standardize, but it's difficult to hold that standardization over a 10, 15, 20-year period of the life of a piece of equipment. We do standardize on the light duty side for cars and trucks, for light duty cars and trucks. We're primarily Ford and some GM now, and we do look at that on a per location basis when we're deploying vehicles and equipment. For example, if a If a location has predominantly Fords already, then we're going to continue to provide Fords there so we don't have to stock GM parts, yes. Things like that.
It seems to me like you would gain some negotiations power with pricing if you only dealt with Ford and could go to GM. And so, you know, working that. So I would think that with a volume, especially in the light duty, you should be able to negotiate either faster deliveries or something because of that standardization.
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, you're correct, and we do. We have very good relationships with the local dealerships, which is who we mm-hmm. ultimately, when we buy a Ford vehicle, it comes from a local Ford dealer, and that's the location where parts and supplies are going to come from as well. So that's a part of a process for us and an ongoing process, day-to-day relationships.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Vance has a question.
I don't have a question. I have a comment to Andy that maybe we found a new use for all these abandoned vehicles. Let's just scrap them for parts. Just saying. Creative solutions.
We need to set up a chop shop.
Or you could always, Houston, one of the cities in my district, is always looking for good used equipment. They need a dump truck. They need a grader. And I think I think you're probably aware of that because I think I set them up with you. But some of the smaller villages, and I know you've got the program, so it's a moot point. But so any other questions? All right, so seeing no other questions from the committee members, thank you, Mr. Bylsma, for your time today. Our next meeting is going to be Tuesday, February 28th, and we will be given a presentation from ADA, which I'm really looking forward to. So seeing no other business before the committee, we will adjourn. Let the record reflect that the time is 2:10, 2:19 p.m.